When Joshua led the Israelites into Canaan, their first battle in the land went incredibly well. It went so well that it wasn't actually a battle. Joshua 6 describes the destruction of Jericho. You probably know the story. The Israelite army marched around the city once a day for 6 days. On the seventh day, they marched around the city 7 times. At the end of the 7th circuit, the priests blew the trumpets and the soldiers shouted. God knocked down the walls of Jericho. The army of Israel overran the city with no opposition. The next city to confront Israel was a podunk little town that was so small it couldn't even afford a full name. All it got were 2 vowels, Ai. And Ai was so small, only a part of the army of Israel went to do battle against it. And to everyone's surprise, the people of Ai defeated the army of Israel. And after such an incredible victory at Jericho, this loss was bewildering. The problem was, God was not with Israel when they fought Ai. Why not? God had given clear commands to Israel when they conquered Jericho. No one was to take one single item of treasure from the city. All the silver, gold, and containers made of bronze and iron were the Lord's. Those things were to be taken out of the city and to the treasury of the Lord. Everything else was to be destroyed with Jericho. However, one man disobeyed and stole something that belonged to God. So Achan swiped gold, silver, and a Babylonian garment. As a result, God allowed Israel to go into battle against Ai without him. And they were defeated by an army that they should have conquered with ease. When God did not go with Israel, they suffered shameful loss. But when God went with Israel, they won victories against impossible odds. And Hebrews 13, verse 5, contains a precious promise. I trust many of you have memorized it. And I do not want to undermine the greatness of that promise this morning, for it is certainly a broad promise that applies to every Christian in every situation. However, the context of Hebrews 13 is very specific. It does not apply it to every situation, but to one particular situation. So let's read Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. It says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, 'I will never leave you nor forsake you.' So we may boldly say, 'The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?'" The specific context of Hebrews 13:5 is that of covetousness. So the promise of the presence of God is shown to be the source of contentment and the subduing of covetousness. And this morning I want to consider covetousness and how God's presence overcomes our tendency to trust riches. Now I know this is going to surprise you, but I'm not going to make it through 2 entire verses in one sermon. So we're going to have to come back to verse 6 next week. But so first though, I want to consider covetousness. And the covetousness in verse 5 is a specific kind of coveting. You might call it greed. And some of your translations may call it the love of money. The classic Charles Dickens character, Ebenezer Scrooge, is probably the most familiar expression of greed. However, being a lover of money is more than just that kind of Scroogey greediness. It is rightly called covetousness because this loving money is an attitude which violates the 10th commandment. Covetousness itself is a broad concept in the New Testament. Colossians chapter 3 verse 5 lists covetousness as a work of the sin nature right alongside fornication and evil desires. Now, Colossians 3 uses a general word for covetousness. It's more general than the specific word used in Hebrews 13. So that what Colossians 3 describes is that really all forms of inappropriate desire. So whether it be the desire for something you should not have, like coveting your neighbor's house, or a desire that becomes a ruling desire in your heart, like a desire which causes strife between you and other believers. That kind of covetousness is forbidden, and we're told in Colossians 3 that it is idolatry. And the covetousness of Hebrews 13 is more specific, as I said. It's a subset of covetousness in general. So do you remember way back in your high school days studying taxonomy? Animals are described by a family, an order, and a genus, and a species. So that all canines, for example, are of the genus Canis. Your pet dog is Canis familiaris. A gray wolf is Canis lupus. Now, one commentator described loving money as one species of the genus covetousness. I think that's a great way to describe it. It's one form of this broader category of covetousness. And I'm going to focus this morning on the love of money, but I want to warn us first that all forms of covetousness are idolatry, everything underneath it. So we talk about the love of money this morning. We're talking about idolatry. And generally, we would say covetousness is idolatry because it is a desire for some created thing that is greater than the desire for God. Loving money is also idolatry for some other specific reasons. And the command of Hebrews 13 is a command to live a life. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Live a life that is not driven by the love of money. Now sometimes not only do we think of Scrooge when we think of this kind of loving money, sometimes we think of the incredibly rich. Now, and riches themselves and the possession of them is not indicate the presence or lack of a love of money. So you don't have to be rich to be a lover of money. And you don't have to hoard your wealth to be a lover of money. The lover of money is simply someone who makes getting a little bit more, getting something else, for whatever purpose, their primary goal. So the lover of money is going to have a mind filled with plans to get more, or with dreams of what could be done with a certain amount of money. So that dreaming what you would do if you won the lottery, especially if it's a persistent thing, not just a momentary thing, but a persistent imagining of what you would do with one, if you won the lottery, is symptomatic of loving money. And the lover of money generally will make great sacrifices to try to possess something else, what they desire. They will sacrifice their family, sometimes they'll sacrifice their health. They will sacrifice their relationships. Most frequently, they sacrifice their walk with God for a little more. And they justify this in a lot of different ways. They speak of trying to make a better life for their kids, just trying to get ahead in this world. They speak of wanting a little bit of peace of mind or of having financial security later in life. And these are not all necessarily bad things. But that's not the question. The question is not whether the justification of habits are wrong. The question is, do these actions, do this thinking process, does it reveal that you love money more than you love God or others? Does your mind and your heart, does your behavior and your work show that you love money too much? So do you live and act as if money is necessary for you to be secure, content, or at peace? Do your actions show that you trust what you have more than you trust God? So what it really gets down to is, how do you respond when setbacks erase your savings account? What do you do when your retirement account takes a huge hit? What happens in your heart and your mind when you are faced with a bill that you can't pay right now? Are you fearful? Do you worry? Are you unable to be at peace? Are you unable to read the Word of God? Are you unable to pray without your mind being consumed by that specific problem? Are you agitated and uncertain over the condition of the stock market or the real estate market, over the condition of your savings account or your bills or your pantry or your checking account? When those things are not as you would like them to be, what do you do? What does your heart and your mind do? Do you doubt God's goodness? Do you worry that some other bad thing is about to happen? So that if finances are the source of conflict, of fear, worry, and unrest in your heart, then you're showing that you're a lover of money who is relying on money to give you what ultimately comes from God. In other words, money has become an idol. And the love of money is idolatry because it does not trust God. So go back to Matthew 6. The love of money will not dare risk not having something. Whatever that something is, whatever the love of money desires at that moment or feels it must have. And as a result, the money lover serves their money. They make their possessions their God by devoting their life to riches. Matthew chapter 6 verse 19, we see the command of Jesus where he says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth." And then he says in verse 20, "Lay up for yourself treasures in heaven." I think the language of investment is helpful here as you're thinking about what Christ is saying. Because Jesus is speaking of how we invest our money. You know, on a purely physical standpoint, from a purely physical standpoint, we invest our treasures in accounts and assets that are designed to grow over the years in hopes that the added income will be sufficient maybe to tide us through unexpected problems or to give us a certain level of ease and comfort later in life. The book of Proverbs speaks of the wisdom of financial planning. And so we can't read this as Jesus condemning all forms of savings and investing. However, when the money we invest is truly our treasure, when we love it, then there's a huge problem. Because he says, verse 21, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So the question is, where's my treasure? The answer is, where's my heart? What fills my heart? What motivates me? What gives me great joy? What gives me great satisfaction? What gives me peace? What gives me contentment? And if it's in money, you're showing that that is what you truly treasure is. So that when a large portion of your thoughts are on how to grow your money faster, When idle moments are naturally filled with imaginations of how you're going to spend whatever returns you have. When your thoughts and desires are filled by the money you have invested, then you have a money problem. You have a God problem, in fact. When your desire to invest as much as possible, as quickly as possible, to get as much return as possible hinders your good works, then you have a money problem. When your need to have a certain amount stored away for a rainy day hinders your good works, you have a money problem. So when you say, I can't do that, yeah, I know I have the money, or I have the clothes, or I have the ability, but I can't do that. Or, well, I will only do as much as is necessary to ease my conscience. I could give more, but I'm not. This gets me by. You look at it and say, that money is mine. I worked hard for it. I deserve all the benefit and pleasure that comes from it. Then you have a money problem. You have made that money an idol and become its servant, because your money, your possessions are keeping you from serving God. Now, notice verse 24 here in Matthew 6. It says, no man can serve two masters. Notice that the money lover is not master. Neither is the God worshiper, but I'm going to come back to that in a second. The money lover is not master. He is slave. He is in bondage to what he has and what he desires to have. Now, I know somebody at some point is going to be thinking, boy, it'd be really nice to be in bondage to lots of money. It's not a bad way to be enslaved. I've got a great car. I've got a great house. I've got lots of comforts. Who cares if I'm enslaved? I can't help but think of the Israelites who say, we wish we were in Egypt because we had onions and garlic and all the meat we wanted. But being in bondage is still being in bondage. And the one enslaved to money is ultimately enslaved to emptiness and futility. I skipped over it, but back in verse 19, Jesus points us to the reality that everything we possess disappears. Your house will rot. Your car is rusting in the parking lot right now. It's going to fall apart. Even the things that you keep for all of your life, when you die, you leave it behind. Who knows what your kids are going to do with it from there? However, those who serve God find He is a gracious master who gives eternal rewards. So He may require you to do with less now. As we're talking about all of this, I am not at all saying that if you serve God, He will give you more now. In fact, I think biblically speaking, the odds are if you serve God faithfully, He will require you to do with less. But He also promises you He will give you far greater treasures later. And those will last forever. So go back to verse 24. No man can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot divide your loyalties between God and riches. God will not have it. He's very clear. You will have no other gods but Him. He demands you worship Him alone. Nor will money be satisfied with a dual devotion. Riches will slowly but certainly push away anything which takes away from your single-minded love of money. Especially as we talk about a worship of God. Riches can put up with the worship of sports and other things like that, but it will not stand the worship of God. They are mutually exclusive, so that Jesus says you cannot serve God and mammon. And the next several verses show us why you cannot serve God and riches. I'm not going to read them but I want to remind us of what they say, but what it's telling us, what Jesus is saying is that service of riches distrusts God. So this form of covetousness, this money loving, is idolatry because it trusts in wealth instead of God. It makes its ultimate source of peace and security possessions rather than God. So what is the solution to a heart that wrongly treasures treasure? What frees us from this slavery to wealth? We consider how marvelously God has provided for all of His creation. Look at the birds. When was the last time you saw a robin planting a garden? How many times have you been in the woods and stumbled across a family of chickadees building a barn to store all their food in? Who takes care of them? Who feeds them every day? You do, right? You go out and fill up your bird feeder and watch the squirrels eat it all. We know there are thousands more birds in the woods and survive than rely upon our backyard bird feeders. You think about those little gray and white birds. You see them on the shoulder of the road during this time of year. I have no idea what they're called. You can barely see them until all of a sudden they're flown up right in front of you. I've never seen one at our bird feeder anyway. Who feeds them? Who takes care of them? God takes care of them all, even the least of them. Or look at the flowers. Have you ever seen a flower straining and struggling to make itself prettier than its neighbor? When was the last time that you heard a clattering in your garden in the middle of the night? You walked outside to find your tulips hard at work on sewing machines to make themselves newer, brighter clothes for the morning. The flowers rely fully on the care of God to clothe them however He sees fit. And God clothes the flowers in that which is far lovelier, far more wonderful than anything that Solomon wore at the height of his glory. Nothing coming from the fashionable designers today compare to the brilliant adornments of the lilies, the gladiolas, the daffodils, the cherry blossoms. Yet how long do those flowers last? How long does that beauty stay? A few days for some? A few weeks for others? A season at the most, yet God dresses them in exorbitant fashion. Look at yourself. Can you worry yourself taller? Can you add 1 foot to your height by laying awake at night, dreaming about it, and imagining what you would do if you were taller? Even as a kid, you might have thought, I wish I was, whatever, I want to be 6.5 feet tall so I can play basketball. Did your dreaming about it and worrying about it make you 1 inch taller? We're powerless to do something which every child experiences. And on the other hand, God has shown Himself immensely powerful to provide extravagantly for things far less valuable than you and I. Why then would we trust in what we can do and what we can store up and what riches promise instead of trusting what God has done and promises to continue to do? Consider the birds. Consider the lilies. Consider God. And let your lifestyle, your conduct, be without covetousness. Have a pattern, habit, course of life, a way of living that is unshackled by the love of money. Instead, be content with what you have. And we see exactly these same instructions in 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy 6 verse 10 uses essentially the same word found in Hebrews 13:5, warning us that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And it warns us that the love of money turns people from the faith. Before that warning of the dangers of money loving, we find a positive declaration and an exhortation. Godliness with contentment is great gain. And after the warning against being a money lover, 1 Timothy 6, verse 17 calls the rich to trust God, not their unstable riches. And that's exactly what Hebrews 13 says. Fearlessly trust God's provision in everything. So turn back there to Hebrews chapter 13. And while you're turning back, I want to point you to one other solution to money loving. And we find it in 1 Timothy 6 still. And it's generosity. 1 Timothy 6 commands the rich in this world to be generous and hospitable, to hold loosely to what you have, to use what God has given you for the good of others, to not spend it all on yourself, but to invest it in ministry in some form. So that you do not, you spend your money and your treasures on the needy. You do great good with what you have. You put your money to work in the work of the Lord. And when you do that, you will have treasure that is eternal. So that if you will invest in generosity, charity, and ministry, you will find that you have invested in the one place where your investment will never depreciate and will never be lost. Hebrews 13 verse 5. Instead of a habit of covetousness, we must instead develop a habit of contentment. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said. The solution to covetousness and the source of contentment is the presence of God. When you see his perpetual presence and his unfailing protection, then you'll be content. I believe the greatest statement on contentment in the New Testament is found in Philippians 4. I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. Do you know where Paul learned that? Paul did not learn contentment by having all he wanted or even all he felt he needed. He went hungry. Paul learned contentment in Christ. Because the very next verse is Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So the next time you see Philippians 4:13 written on an athlete's face or on some motivational poster, remember that that verse is talking about contentment. It's talking about being content in all situations through Christ. And a Greek scholar, Kenneth Wiest, says this word content was used by certain Greek philosophers as the ability to resist the shock of circumstances. So that when we are content in God and His provision for us, we are able to remain unmoved even when the world around us is shaking. When God is our contentment, we will not be overthrown and greatly upset by financial turmoil. The second tallest building in the world is in Taiwan, which is one of the most earthquake-prone countries in the world. And to enable that particular skyscraper to withstand large earthquakes, the builders put in its center a gigantic 730-ton counterweight. And when earthquakes cause the building to sway, the counterweight acts like a pendulum to absorb the shock and to keep the tower upright. When we are rocked by unexpected economic downturns or job upheavals or major medical expenses or unexpected losses, if we have already learned to be content in the presence of God, He acts as the counterweight against the forces of the circumstances. Gloriously, the shock of the situation will be borne by His mighty power, not our trembling frame. He will hold us upright no matter how the world around us may shake. Wiest also said that the Christian dependent on the Holy Spirit is independent of circumstances. As a result of this Spirit-dependent independence, we can be content. If we know the unfailing presence of God, we will rest secure in Him. Contentment is not found in the things we possess, but in the God who possesses us. And the great promise of Hebrews 13 verse 5 is, I will never leave you nor forsake you. It's a quote from Joshua chapter 1. On the borders of Canaan, God assured Joshua that victory over the Canaanites was certain because God would not leave him. Those same promise is repeated in various ways found throughout the Bible. It was given by God to Jacob when He assured Jacob that He would be with him and bring him back to the land of Canaan. The prophet Samuel assured the Israelites that God would not forsake His people. David assured Solomon that God would never leave him. David also said, I've been young and am now old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken. Isaiah 41, God promised that He would not forsake the poor and the needy of Israel. And all of those incredible Old Testament promises are encompassed in this repetition of it in the New Testament. But it is also, those Old Testament promises are added to, because as New Testament Christians, we have even that promise made more certain and personal. Because God the Spirit takes up residence in every child of God. So that the moment of salvation, the Holy Spirit moves in and never leaves us. He will reside in us until He brings us to heaven for us to reside with Him. And we have the presence of God that few in the Old Testament ever enjoyed. That continual presence of God is the basis of our contentment. So that we have peace in trouble because God never leaves us. And Hebrews 13:5 contains five negatives. That promise contains five definite negatives. Some of them are lost in translation. But these five negatives stack one on top of the other to declare the absolute impossibility of God ever forsaking us. God says, no, I will not leave you. No, I will not forsake you. Never. That's the promise of God. He will never stop sustaining us. He will never let you sink under the weight of circumstances, so that if you will cling to Him, you will find Him an anchor able to secure your soul, a cable strong to hold you fast, and a lifeboat sufficient to carry you through no matter how fiercely the storm rages. We see in the Gospels Jesus walking calmly across the raging waves of that storm-tossed Sea of Galilee. And He walks over and plucks doubting Peter from destruction in the waves. And that same God who so thoroughly rules the waves and the seas can certainly sustain you through all of the storms of your life. So do you have a deep sense of the presence of God? Do you believe God to be faithful to His promise? Do you know He will supply all your need? Do you know He's your unfailing helper? Are you certain nothing will separate you from His love? Are you convinced that God is working all things for your good? Do you know the sufferings of this world are not comparable to the glories of heaven? When troubles come, when you suffer loss, do your responses show that you trust God? When the money is gone or disappearing, are you still content because you have God? God's presence is the assurance of His provision. His presence is the certainty of His promise. Do not be unsettled by the love of things. Be content by trusting in God, who is present.